This is a HeadGum Podcast.
What's up, shitheads? Welcome back to another episode of High and Mighty. It's me, your host, John Gabris, the number one fuck boy. Number one fuck boy! The fuck boy! Another special fancy episode with the fanmen, I believe, as we're calling ourselves now, as we refuse to be considered fanboys.
Correct.
Since we're in our mid-30s and up. And some of us way up. I'm saying I'm in my early 300s weight-wise. and this is episode 3 of the Fanchi, the Fanman spinoff of High and Mighty. And we're talking about episode 403. And in the studio with us is Hoon Lee, for us, playing one of the most fun fucking characters on television, Job. Job Hoon, thank you for joining
Thanks
us.
Thanks very much.
And of course, as with me as always, are my fellow fandomen, Sean Conroy.
Hello.
Ben Rogers.
How you doing?
We're all a little hungover because we went to the premiere of Banshee last night and it was rather exciting. Got to drink red wine and talk to Ulrich, so I don't think there's a better situation you could be in.
Right.
Free red wine, no less.
Took some of the most unflattering pictures of ourselves
on the red carpet.
On the red carpet
with an iPhone, because the paparazzi wouldn't take our picture. Well,
the funniest part was that there was a woman. This woman was taking our picture just as a favor to us, and a friend of hers was leaving, and she was trying to say goodbye to her, and Gabris was shouting at this woman, going, "We're trying to take a picture. Don't say goodbye right now."
I don't know. Oh, I'm a monster. I'm a monster. Enough about us. Let's turn it to Hoon. We always talk about when we talk about Banshee. What we talk about when we talk about Banshee is Job. Like, he's such a fun character. A character unlike anyone else on TV. And he's played wonderfully by you. And there is a lot of blowing smoke up each other's asses on this podcast, apparently. But we are. And also, we compliment one another.
Smoke, sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's very sincere smoke.
Yeah. Right? It's
the finest, highest quality smoke.
We love Job. And we're just curious, what is that like to get us kicked off? Just talk about a little bit about playing that character or finding that character or reading the first time you got the script or audition, whatever that was like for you.
Oh, man. Well, I when I first got the audition, I had never been asked to audition for a character quite like Job. And for those people that don't know, Job is a transvestite criminal computer hacker with a foul mouth and a terrible temper. And
I don't think you're alone either. I don't think anyone has ever auditioned.
Well, you know, I had never been asked. I mean, the breakdown, I think if I'm remembering correctly, the breakdown said something like, you know, we see a beautiful Asian woman, we don't realize it's a man until she speaks. And I remember calling my agent and being like, they know what I look like, right? Because I know many Asian men that make beautiful women, and I'm
don't
not
we all?
One of them, you know? And he seemed as baffled as me. He was like, they want to see you. So I'm like, all right.
Don't blame me. I don't think you're a beautiful woman.
Yeah, it was like...
That's always a little unflattering when your agent sends you a breakdown. You're like, no. They're like, it's a fat pig. You'll like it.
Yeah, yeah. But in this particular case, they seemed really as baffled as me.
Right,
They were like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I, you know.
Right, that's another thing. When you talk about Job, just it's like saying all that stuff and being an Asian character, too. It's like, that's just, there's so many. It's like. The character is just so like nothing you've seen on television.
And he also kicks ass. Like,
yeah, but I think, you know, I think that's sort of that's just part and parcel of the show.
Right. Everybody's going to kick ass and bash. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty equal opportunity.
We always joke our favorite reveal on the show is when Gordon, who's the mayor, comes in.
Turns out to be
a of course
sniper.
You were a Vietnam sniper.
Yeah.
Like, just everyone. Sugar. Yeah, well, I'm an ex-boxer. Brock's like, all right, guys, shotgun, strip clubs. It's like every character by season 4, it's going to be like, yeah, I know I just walked by in the background, but I'm a Taekwondo champion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's somewhat the rules of the world, you know, and I think that's one of those, you know, there's really a fairly thin line separating a show like ours from something like, you know, like a Game of Thrones.
Right.
I mean, the context is different, but you know, the rules are the rules for that particular world. So
yeah, like I think we see Cruz in this episode, who we've learned is just a Proctor snitch at this point, but then we see her like dismantle a dude, mm-hmm. and you're like, yes, yeah, we know she's gonna be squaring off against Carrie or somebody later. It's so exciting. That's what you love about the show. It's like, fuck yes, of course. This
In this episode,
they have their big stare down.
They have a stare off where you know they're gonna.
Oh, because like she thinks she knows about her vigilante stuff, where she's on to it a little bit. That's this is a great for those. Let's get into right into 403 here. This is Job has been gone.
Yeah,
and it's leaving a Job sized hole in my heart trying to watch the show. That great. We always say on the show too that Banshee has the best cold opens and the best like tags.
Yeah,
great tag to episode two when you're like, "Fuck, thank God he's alive!"
Right,
I can't wait for them to rescue him.
Yeah. I mean, I've been pretty flattered by all of the concern out there, and you know, on some level, you're kind of like, well, you know, our show doesn't leave anything hanging.
Right,
we wrap everything up usually with somebody being killed in a terrifying way, but.
Right, you wouldn't retroactively find out Job is dead.
Yeah, it wouldn't be just somebody
get killed. Yeah,
kind of like P.S. We found out what happened to him.
Yeah, just cut to Hood crying over a grave that says just three letters on it, J.O.B.
So, R.I.P.
R.I.P. J.O.B.
Yeah, but you know the outpouring of kind of concern and support for it was you know very heartwarming in that way. And
that's so cool.
And those scenes were really, I mean, they were. They were tough to film physically, but they were...
The torture stuff?
Yeah, I mean, they're you're not getting actually tortured, but you're having to deal with sort of the same sorts of constraints and, you know, being buckled down for long periods of time, and they're trying things out on you to see what hurts and what doesn't hurt.
Sprayed you with a fire hose.
Yeah, I mean, there's... That was actually really surprisingly pleasant, I guess. That was like
just that on-camera enema you received?
No, I like a nice strong shower. And
I watched it for the second time today, and a realization I had as I was watching it is, for an actor doing that, you're putting so much into your reactions to that stuff. That seems like a hard...
It's like Pavlovian. You start to feel like you've been tortured because you're screaming in pain. Also, we see Job facial hair, which is an exciting twist.
There are going to be a lot of disappointed people out there. I'll put that out there right now. There's like, you know, just the... We were looking at an Adam and John Tropper and OC were... We wanted to bring Job as far away from what we knew as possible to show kind of the transition, how much time had passed, how much damage had been done, how much had been done to him. And, you know, there's the appearance is a large part of Job, and that the fact that he takes so much time with his external affect and his way of presenting himself to the world. So the idea that he had no control over that is something that reads much more strongly for a character like that than it would for another character.
Yeah, the beard is literally like, oh, Job looks unfabulous for the first time. And you know that's as bad as being whatever the UV ray torture. Banshee's so specific. It's like, let's hold his eyes open in front of a wall.
I always wonder what the research team is like. There's just like endless sleepless nights because they just have all this information in
their
head.
And the way that they say this was invented by somebody.
Yeah, for 9/11.
After 9/11, yeah.
It was too. It was too bad.
Because it was blinding people.
Yeah. So we're gonna try it on you.
Yeah, exactly.
Job. Let's talk about Job. Let's talk about some of our favorite Job moments. Do you have any specific scenes or things you got to do for us as all like actors? I'm putting in quotes because we want to be, but like those things where like, oh, I the scene where you're firing like the big heavy machine gun and the guy drops the grenade onto the that's just like, if I could be cast as a guy who shoots a machine gun in one thing, that would be so exciting. And you get to do so much fun shit. What was something for you that stood out as really fun?
It's funny because that came in season three, so by that time you're kind of numb to certain things. Like you realize it in retrospect, but I was doing a tally just for myself, kind of taking accounting of what had happened in the show and things I'd been allowed to do. And You know, I was kind of like, God, I've been very close to a lot of explosions. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If you don't really think about it, it's like, yeah, I remember that.
And yeah, your own house, like your own.
Yeah, that was my first explosion.
That's a great moment, too, because
that's
out of.
That is a great moment.
That's like a tone-setting moment that you don't realize that early on.
That's
in the pilot, right? And I remember specifically asking, because I had no experience with it, and I said, this is going to be really loud. What's going to happen in there? Like, well, have you ever heard like a garbage dumpster being dropped on the ground? I was like, yeah, it's about like that. And it was so much louder than that. It was like exponentially louder than that.
Have you ever heard a garbage dumpster explode?
Yeah, exactly. From that point forward, I was like, I am going to be lied to. So this is good to know for the future.
But what's so great about that moment too is not just like, oh, here's this guy blowing up his own house, but that Job does it so almost casually, like strutting away from it over his shoulder.
Yeah.
Just boom.
I know, just like...
Yeah, it keeps the catwalk attitude, even doing all the badass stuff.
I mean, I think the way that they allowed that scene to play out was, you know, you're especially early on, you're trying to find your toehold with the character. You don't know the character that well. You don't know how it's going to be edited together. You don't know what decisions are going to be made that are out of your hands. So when it kind of came together and in the process of doing it, the idea that he was somewhat playing possum when he was being beaten up is hugely informative to this character. And it actually allows us to both sort of play with the stereotypes that people have grown accustomed to with in terms of a feminized man or something like that, and also explode them at the same time, you know. And that was really key as we kept working through the character. You brought up, actually, for example, this is something I feel more comfortable talking about now that the show's ending, but, you know, for example, the fact that Job's Asian is almost never referenced.
Right.
And in particular, the relationship between Job and Hood is special to me because Hood is never comments on his affect. He never comments on anything about him.
As a matter of fact, I was rewatching, just to interrupt you briefly, I was rewatching some earlier Job stuff. And when you're doing the burlesque show or whatever, that cabaret show, it's one of the few times you see Hood genuinely smiling. He's like watching you and he's like kind of clapping. And you're like, you don't see Hood happy almost ever on the show, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it was a moment where he's just like, this is a fun show, isn't it? Like, he brings a woman's like, you know where all the cool stuff happens, huh? And it's like that, and that's a great, that's an insane moment that your character is firing machine guns, being in explosions, and getting to do cabaret.
I always saw you as Hood's parent, almost like a mother figure.
I thought it was very much like, you know, he's very much like a sibling relationship, and the roles kind of alternate, you know. And I have friends like that. I'm sure most of us do. There are people that kind of alternate in
between
their relationship
being your big
to
brother
you,
and
like,
your little brother, depending
and,
on
in times like that. And we tried to be very specific about their relationship because chronologically, they've actually known each other the longest out of everybody in the show.
Greg predates prison and predates...
Predates prison, predates Anna, predates all of this. So the fact that Hood never comments on his affect is part of that, because that any issue he would have had with that was years and years and years and years ago.
Right.
So it wouldn't make sense for him to comment on it now. Whereas you see it with Sugar, where Sugar will
which
kind
is
of
another great relationship.
That dynamic on the show is
Sugar.
so fun.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you see like a new deep friendship forming, but it's still early.
Yeah.
So you kind of get this contrast and
Sugar,
it allows us to show that.
Sugar's,
you know,
just so like... Just
you could imagine what like
aback.
A 60-year-old African American who works in a small town bar, how he would feel. Like, that is like city mouse, country mouse.
That's the spinoff I would most like to see happen. Is
I would do that. In
Job and Sugar, like odd couple, roommates.
The buddy comedy.
Yeah. When the stealing of the ID card scene, whatever. I think that's season three. That whole thing is like when he's like, "Why did I have to wear a suit?"
Yeah,
it's like,
because
there ain't no sweatpants Monday.
Frankie and I get along very well. We always have since the show started, and I think that they, you know, they fastened onto that pretty quickly as well, and it became this sort of feedback loop where we were able to keep building on it.
Yeah, it's great. It's like they give each other shit the way people that are friends in real life give each other shit. You know?
But there's this great thing about, you know, when Hood first walks into Banshee and there's a recognition on Sugar's part that he's an ex-con. Like
Immediately, they
know each other. You know?
Yeah.
And that happens with Job and Sugar too. They, you know, people that are somewhat of a like breed sort of find each other quickly in this world.
Yeah, there's like that unspoken thing of like, we all carry ourselves a certain way. It looks like we all are criminals in some capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Job does the thing where, what is it? The guy is ripping Sugar off because of who he
The boxer. Yeah.
And Job goes and gets his money back for him. And like, figures out on his computer what's going on.
I mean, Job doesn't, for all of the complaining Job does about money, he doesn't. He can get money whenever he wants. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty clear. So
it's funny. It's like he doesn't want the money. He wants the status of winning in a weird way. I feel like that's what, like, for Job, it's more like, it's like, it seems like it's like a video game where he's like, I just want to have all the credits I can have.
Well, there's, I think there's some, you know, there's, I know a bunch of people in tech that work in technology, and there's, you know, there's a pride factor in doing a certain kind of work and in having, a certain level of skill, that sort of thing. But I think also he's an incredibly loyal person when you look at him. He doesn't have a lot of friends, and the people that he's friends with are family. And even people like Carrie, who he has big problems with, legitimate problems with, they're still family. They're still, they're of a like kind, and everybody else is everybody else. You know, they don't really count.
For a show that has like some of the best violence and explosions and fighting, I could watch the four of them sit in the bar and just argue and talk for a full hour, like a bottle episode where everyone's just hanging out drinking Jameson, which I guess is everyone's favorite drink in Banshee, at least.
I always assumed we had some sort of weird sponsor.
Yeah.
I think that's just what we had.
Episode, it was an 18-year-old bottle of Glenlivet.
Right.
Yeah, we've upgraded this season.
You don't have that in Banshee. Yeah. That would have been robbed day one if someone found out you had a $40 bottle of booze or above.
Right. The cars get nicer, the guns get bigger.
Oh, right, the Maybach.
Yeah.
Oh, the Maybach, and then Sugar's fucking dope-ass muscle car.
I'm curious. So you said before about the explosion in the house being and playing possum and how much that was informative for building the character. Can you remember any other moments like that that you found along the way that you found really added on and helped you kind of find Job early on?
Yeah, you know, actually, in reading the early scripts, one thing that started to jump out was There's a natural rhythm that Tropper has when he writes, and Tropper has handled the vast majority of the Job material. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he's how conscious he is of it, but I noticed that there were certain patterns that were starting to emerge. And so early on, even in the first season, Job might talk when he's talking to someone. He might call them Sugar or Baby or whatever, and or he calls a motherfucker a lot, you know, and that sort of thing. But
I love he calls women sister. It's so awesome. Yeah.
But there's this, there ended up being kind of a specificity to it, which I was a little surprised to find, but I thought was pretty clear. And so I tried to, I asked permission to sort of really make that as clear as possible for myself. So throughout the series, the word baby is really only reserved for Hood. It's his term of endearment for Hood. He doesn't really call anybody else that, and he rarely curses at Hood. And this is I think there's maybe two or three moments in the series where he kind of curses at him. There's a huge amount of respect that he pays him, that he doesn't pay anybody else. And that, again, it's these sort of ways that you use the tools that you're allowed to have to sort of build some sort of infrastructure for yourself about how you're going to respond to people. And so that sort of stuff kind of leapt out early. So I wouldn't say it was a particular moment, but you start to see a pattern emerge about how people behave.
And then you're able to internalize that and be like, hey, in this moment, we should hit that pattern again.
Right,
like, as an actor, you can make those choices.
It gives you a way to, it gives you something to hang on to when you're not sure what to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not sure how to play this scene, or I'm not sure how to rhythmically sort of, like, measure these beats out, and then you have this sort of playbook of, okay, these are the things I know about these characters.
Yeah, and I know this is my dynamic with Hood. I know it's my dynamic, so let me build it from there.
And so, like, with Sugar, it's real banter, you know, and all the things you think about from, you know, screwball comedies on, you think about that, and you're like, so it's important if the scene is unbalanced. If Job is just yelling at Sugar, it doesn't work. If Sugar doesn't get him back in some way, it doesn't work. So there's that scene in the bar where, like, that's actually more to your point, where, you know, he's doing the cash machine.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is pissing Job off
the noise.
To no end, right? But you'll notice, like, in that scene, even though Job is kind of giving him these verbal zingers, like watching the History Channel or whatever it may be, you know, it's really Sugar who has the last laugh because he punches the machine one last time in the scene. So even though it's not verbal, Sugar has ways to get back at him.
Right.
And it's that sort of back and forth that ends up becoming important in the relationship. So if you see it and the scene doesn't quite have that, you might ask for it, or you might, you know, if you see an imbalance there, maybe you trim a little bit of what you're doing so that you can kind of keep that balance, but that ball kind of bouncing between the two of you. And that sort of stuff that's hugely fun for me because, you know, I was fortunate enough to get along with the cast very well. So then you feel like you're kind of playing a team sport, and that's always more fun for me, you know, like.
Do you turn on, because you found such a great voice for
Joe. I was
thinking
about that too. Yeah. Where does the voice come from?
Yeah, what was the process like of finding that voice? How did it happen?
A lot of it came out right away, just in the initial audition. Uh-huh. And I'm flattered people give me that
because it's clearly not your voice.
Right, right.
And you're great with dialects. I think your work on Bosch was also really great.
Oh, thanks.
I was like, oh, wow, Job. And such a great, different, clear character that you added in that.
Yeah.
When you're on set, do you keep talking as Job?
No.
Or, okay, you can turn it on and off.
Well,
you're not Daniel Day-Lewis-ing all your castmates. Like,
that would be the least popular. Job works in the world of Banshee. That would be, and everyone like, you know, in social media, they'd be like, oh, I want a friend like Job. It's like, you don't want a friend like Job. You really, this guy's incredibly judgmental, you know, like in a terrible way. And he might cut
and
you.
He has all of your passwords.
Yeah.
In the
yeah. You do want someone as loyal as him, obviously, these sorts of things. But, you know, the heightened reality of the show is not anything like real life, so you don't really want these people walking around.
Are you murderers. Telling me that hackers can't open select windows or doors from complete distance? That's like one of my favorite things. It's like, Hood, turn to your left. The door is now open. You know what I'm
saying?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Like
all locks have electric, are like smart locks.
Yeah, yeah. This is the thing that's interesting. It's, you know, when you're dealing with these sorts of genres, it's, those conventions end up being part of. You know, I think about it like a pop song or a rock song, something like that, where like everybody knows the chorus is coming. You
right.
know? That's part of the enjoyment. Like
that's
built to the chorus.
Certainly what we get out of it. We sort of mentioned it to Targum. We said the word trope and he got all frustrated. And he was like, it's a positive thing. We're like, I love the moment when the hero decides to cut his beard and shave his head and get back to business. I love guys and gals, you know, like over. Like accentuating loading weapons. Yeah, I'm into the mainframe. Like, I love all those.
Every team needs a guy who has Job's role.
Right.
You're right.
Like,
right.
Like Emilio Estevez in Mission Impossible. Like, yes. Somebody who's at the computer telling everybody, where am I going now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's great Job moment I recently saw was the one where you're like, do you want to know where I am? And you're like at like Seaside, New Jersey or something like that.
Yeah.
And you're like, the girl walks by and she goes, is that a cape? And you're like, it's Diane von Furstenberg, chica, go get pregnant.
Yeah.
It's like, she's like, hey, she's like 17. It's such an awesome moment in that it's, you're dressed like a, what's the famous black and white Fellini movie or whatever, you're dressed like in like
Eight
a big
and a half.
Yeah, you're dressed in like that cloak, nun's garb. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. That whole moment is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean, though. There's a lot of people give me too much credit in terms of determining the voice of Job. I think so much of that is in the writing. So much of it is in the bounce of the rhythm of the writing. And then, and was present there in season one and season two in particular. And from there, you can kind of extrapolate. It was easier to make the rest of it your own and to play off of what was given to you by the other cast members and things like that. But I felt like it was kind of there. And other things, too, that, you know, you might focus on sort of the attitude. But really, for me, my audition scene and the first scene I shot was the fight in the diner with these rednecks.
Oh.
That was a great moment.
Got a narc on a sister.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I love that line.
And that was like that was one of the first things I did, and I'm like trying to navigate heels and and women's clothing for the first time and a butterfly knife, and then I'm doing a stunt fight for the first time, which I've never really done. I ended up cutting like one of the stunt guys' heads, and he was like, I'm fine. I'm like, all right.
That's I was
eating, but okay. You know, and So there were all of these moving parts for someone who had had no experience with this. But the thing I was, like, for the audition and for that scene, the thing I was focusing on, the thing that I felt I could access, was this is a person who literally in the midst of helping his friend in a critical situation.
All right, because Hood's on the other line. He's like,
he's trapped in a, you know, in this museum. He's going to take a moment to go and handle these people.
Because he doesn't take shit.
Yeah, and it's like, who is that person that's going to do that, knowing also that he has this incredibly strong tie to this other person? Like, his own need to deal with his rage, it's going to take precedence in this moment, but also a certain level of confidence that he can take care of it in 30 seconds.
And also a certain level of confidence in Hood knowing, hey, look, you're a badass, I'm a badass, you're going to be okay, I'm handling it.
And so those things start to kind of tell you who this person is, sort of like with negative space. Like, what does he choose not to do?
Right.
He doesn't choose to ignore it and just deal with the problem at hand. He decides this won't take long. And goes and deals with it, you know. So you have this sort of understanding, but also this sense that, you know. So for that moment, it's like he's got to be so enraged or something, in you know, put into such a place that he's going to make that call. So I wanted to play against it, like make him as calm as possible in that moment, and show that this is someone who maybe is the way he is because he has to be. Like, he has to be controlled.
Well, you feel like, I mean, you know, unfortunately somebody like that probably has had to deal with stuff like that on a regular basis throughout their life.
You know? You look at a person that's so meticulously constructed and has chosen to put that out there to the world. You know, I always thought of him less like putting on some sort of an affect and more like he just decides to externalize however he feels on any given day.
Yeah, I think the first big outfit change for Job, it told a lot about the character to me, because he doesn't dress one certain way.
Yeah.
When you see him in a wildly different getup in another scene, it's like, oh, wow, this guy's on a whole nother level. Like, this is like his personality.
Yeah, there's like one when you're in like a corset. There's one like, you know, and it's like, and it all feels like he's like, this is what is needs for today. In a weird way.
Leopard print painted on his head sometimes.
That's an awesome look too. So that it's funny you said, you mentioned having never done a fight. I was curious, in your career, have you done fight choreography or dressing like, or
no? I mean, I hadn't done either, and I learned a lot about myself in this show. I learned a lot about you know, the things that were enjoyable about it, and I found that I really enjoyed the physical side of the show, because I found it like it was another opportunity to look at character. And so, like, I worked pretty closely with a stunt team because I'm old and things are broken. And so, like, I need as much time as I would constantly grill Chopper. Be like, if you have a fight coming up for me, give me as much notice as possible. I need to stretch for months.
I need to drink a lot of water.
There has to be a lot of mental preparation. But, you know, you start to see these things that emerge. And, you know, knowing that he was a guy that was close to Hood, one thing you see with Hood right away is that Hood is very much in the mode of a gladiator. And that's why I've always seen him, which is almost all of his fights, it's a man entering an arena. He's surrounded by a circle of men. He's in a cage. He steps out into that. And that's a very, like, you know, it's incredibly uber masculine kind of combat situation. And so I was like, I want to do something else. Like, I want to create a contrast to that. So we would talk to the stunt team and be like, I think Job is always trying to escape. He's always trying to get out of the circle. Right. And so even in the second season, when he's, you know, runs into all of Rabbit's men and the priest's men, he leaves the church. Essentially, that's one long flight out of the church. That's essentially what it is.
Right.
And so all the combat is incidental to him.
It's just what has you have.
Yeah.
To
he
do
has to get out.
Yeah.
So even when it's mano a mano, it's a lot of breaking down problems, which I thought made sense for the character. So,
and it is like a programmer's approach to the situation in a way too, where it's like, here's our end goal. Whatever bugs we hit along the way, we will break out, but we're trying to build this, whatever.
I mean, you look at Hood, and the thing I think that's so heroic about the Hood character is that Hood is like driven by this sort of ferocity, this relentlessness. He does not give up. You know, he does not stop, you know, and he's kind of at the heart of it, though, for most of the time. It's like this it's usually a core of love, weirdly. Like, he's fighting for someone,
yeah,
right? And it's similar in that way to Carrie and Anna, you know, that fighting style. But I thought, you know, Job should be outmatched a lot. Like, he's not like them, you know. So his asset is his brain, you know. So in the fight itself, again, this is stuff that's largely for us to kind of create a structure to understand what's happening out of a vacuum sometimes.
Right.
But for the working with the stunt team, we would often talk about it like, let's create a problem he has to solve in the fight. So in Genoa, when he's fighting Colonel Stowe's right-hand man, you know, this guy Mark, who's a phenomenal, you know, martial artist, and, you know, like, I think he was a two-time Taekwondo karate champion at one point. But we knew he had great kicks. Like, we knew he was a great kicker. And that's what the stunt guys told me going into it. So I was like, let's use that. Let's exploit that. And maybe he's just going to destroy Job, because he has two fights with this guy.
Right.
And in the first fight, I'm like, let's have him destroy him with his legs. Just like, he cannot get close. That kind of made sense, because a lot of what we had played with Job before is grappling. It's kind of like jiu-jitsu
kind of like
type thing.
Yeah.
You know, again, which makes sense. He's kind of like using his smaller size against bigger opponents, those sorts of things. So I'm like, so he can't get close. So this leg is just coming out and just taking him down and taking him down. And I said, and so that's the problem he has to figure out. So in the second fight, we set that up again. He starts kicking him again. And then Job starts to figure out how to take the leg away.
Yeah.
So he takes the belt off. So he has reach. Right. He wraps the ankle up so he can do that. And then he goes at the knee. So now this guy has to go to something else. And now he goes to a knife. But that brings him closer. So now Job has a shot because he's better in his wheelhouse.
Level the plane.
Oh, that's so awesome.
So that was just like, you start thinking about, okay, how can this movement inform what I understand about this person, you know? And for, you know, it's often done in contrast. Like, so I saw what was happening with Hood. I was like, we should find a different thing to do, so that there's more variety in how we think about the combat.
Yeah, we mentioned that to Chopper, that one of the fun things about Banshee is that, yeah, there's awesome fight scenes, but it's always like, it's not all martial arts. It's sometimes brawling. It's sometimes weapons, sometimes blunt weapons, sometimes guns, or there's full on like seven guys with machine guns versus seven guys with machine guns.
And there's also always tremendous attention to detail, even with it, like that you might not even necessarily notice unless you're looking for it.
Yeah,
like the stuff you're talking about. If somebody was just watching the show, they wouldn't necessarily go, oh, I see what's going
on.
Here. But it informs the atmosphere. Somehow.
Well, I mean, I'm a firm believer that even if it's not, even if those specific points aren't detectable by the person
viewing
it, definitely
makes a difference.
It changes your performance.
Yeah.
And so you're bringing something more to it, you know. And if you're having a fight scene where, and even if it's just for me, if I need to process something as I'm having this fight, that's different from being in an animal primal place.
Right.
Those are different impulses to act on,
and you got
to
play those two different ways.
And you play those different ways. So there are moments where, you know, one thing that I remember, there's a prison fight that Ivana had, and there's a couple shots where she's just like letting her pure Eastern European rage like it just comes out, and it's so thrilling, you know. Yeah. And you know, you start to see the places where she intersects Rabbit or where she intersects Hood,
yeah,
and the places where they're in common in these moments, and that ends up being these sorts of linchpins that you can kind of can start to string a connection between. And Ant has this, you know, his face is unbelievably expressive, and so in these fights you see him just battered to a pulp, and then there's this moment where his eyes just like turn on and you're like, it's on, you know.
Like, it's like his version of Burton's taking his glasses
off.
We say that, we said it a few times here, we'll say it again. Anthony has like the best watery eye look in the business. You know, like where he looks like when he gets a little upset or a real, and his eyes just like, they're like oceans, and then he just all of a sudden it glimmers a little bit, and you're like, is Hood sad?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, he's pissed.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty great to see the results of the care and attention that people, that, you know, my colleagues put into it. You know, I'm a huge fan of them, and
makes you step up your game
too.
In a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And everyone worked really, really hard. You know, that's, I feel like we can walk away from the show, whether people liked it or not, whether people, you know, however they felt about it, I feel like we left everything out on the table. Like, we left everything on the field. And And that's like the best you can hope for sometimes, you know.
We've talked about this, the show, in terms of its relationship to sort of the action movies that we grew up on, which were super fun, but there's a whole other level to... Because a lot of times in those action movies, the action sort of seems all the same. Like it's, you know... And what's fun about this show is that it's kind of taking that action and going like, there's another way to do it, and there's, you know, and that's kind of
well, what... we have this advantage by doing multiple seasons in TV, which is, you know, for me, the heart of Banshee is family. For me, it's always been family, and it's kind of wrapped up in this action movie jacket, right? But if you look at what happens, it's like this guy gets out of prison, looks for the love of his life. She's married to another man who's raising his daughter. We find out later he's bought a house for them to live in, you know, that's in this locket. It's incredibly like, it's all about heart. And then who does he fall in? He falls in with a group of people that are also similarly sort of orphaned in the world. Proctor is excommunicated from his family, takes in his niece, is just trying to find this connection. Gordon, he's the other man. Like everything, Rabbit is the big bad. He's just trying to get his daughter back.
Right.
You know, like there's that thread of it, if you can... Because we have the time to explore that, it gives, we hope that it gives the action more meaning, because it's not just a bunch of movement for the sake of movement. People are swinging at each other because they have something at stake. And for me, it's like, that's what I think people have, I hope that's what people have latched onto. The people that really enjoy the show, they enjoy it so much and they enjoy the fun of it, but they do feel attached to it. And I like to think that that's part of it, that there's some sense that they tap into that sense of, you know, everyone is trying to find a family in this world, and everyone is kind of being denied their family in this world, which is a terrible, terrible thing.
I'm hoping, I mean, I don't know if this is really going to happen, but I'm hoping the finale ends with the whole cast singing Rainbow Connection together.
Covered in blood.
Firing rounds off.
Yeah, it's just terrible. It's like the most horrifying. Yeah, it's in somebody's mind, and they've got a spike through their mouth. Yeah,
it's also great. I think
completely undoes everything we like about
it. Yeah, exactly. It's like the anti-Roseanne ending.
Well, it is also one of those things too, where like it's a difference between, like, if we're comparing this to the action movies, it's a difference between trying to teach a karate master how to act versus having actors learn to
execute
stunts. Because then when. For the other 37 minutes of the episode that isn't action
the
set pieces, you can,
yeah, you
can you're not listening to guys who doesn't even sound like English is their first language.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, they're, and actually, in the movies we grew up on, most of those guys' English wasn't their first language.
I mean, I think we really tried to have our cake and eat it too, you know. And I mean, Ant in particular, the demands on him were very, very high, physically and just mentally, because he was working so many hours in very trying situations. He got his lips split open day one,
right?
Like close to the first take, I think, if not the first take. It really kind of sets the tone, you know?
And he's, you know, just like looking, calling his agent that night. Hey.
No, and he set the tone too.
Can you
understand me? He's like, let's keep shooting. I mean, he set the tone too.
That's awesome.
And I heard about that remotely. I'm like, oh, okay.
It was crazy to learn that Anthony had no, like, he's not a fighter, like, not previously a fighter.
We got very lucky. I mean, we got very lucky in the sense, in two ways. We have coordinated people that actually, and sometimes, you know, you come to understand that that's not always the case.
Like, just that an actor isn't necessarily coordinated.
Like, yeah, or they're maybe good in a very specific way. Like, they can play basketball, but if you ask them to throw a punch, they're lost, you know? And we had a core group of people that were all very coordinated, which was really helpful. But then we also had a stunt team that I think, you know, really went above and beyond. They basically had, like, an open gym policy. They pretty much kept their door open, and if anyone wanted to train at any time, you could. And for someone like myself that didn't feel terribly secure about my knowledge in those things, that was a huge asset, if only to build confidence, you know, if only to say that I could walk into the day of shooting knowing we had a big day ahead of us, and I could worry about the acting part.
Knowing that you were ready for the physical part.
Yeah, that at least I wouldn't hold us back in that way. If there was something that really required a stunt double to go, then that's what they're going to do, and I don't have any issue with that. But knowing that my mind wasn't occupied by that. That
yeah, like it's hard enough just to memorize lines. It's hard enough just to get the find the emotional core of the scene. All that stuff is hard. Mm-hmm. Then on top of it, if you're standing on a pickup truck driving backwards, it's like, holy shit, I better be ready.
You know, and this is a sort of show where we're trying to pack a lot into it, and we're working with the traditional constraints of television and striving for something more. And if that's the case, then you're like, where are the efficiencies that we can gain? What can we try to do? And one of them is like, as prepared as we can be. You know, if you're going to do a fight scene and you have the ability to do it in 3 takes versus 10 takes, you're helping everybody. You're helping yourself because you're not getting more tired.
Yeah. It's also always frustrating when you see actors doing anything physical on screen and it's clear that they have no idea what they're doing. Like it takes you out. Like if you think about like Leonardo DiCaprio in Basketball Diaries playing basketball, you're like, oh, he never touched a basketball before in his life. You know, on set was the first time he ever did it. So you guys were able to like pull that off in a way that never took you out of the show as you're watching.
Well, I mean, I think if you later on in the show, Matty Roush comes forward, Matt Servito comes forward in more combat-oriented roles. Right. And, you know, those were things that there was a lot of demand placed on them. And so to be able to do it was great. But it was also at that point, it was, you know, people had gotten to know each other. You kind of understand each other's capabilities a bit more. You understand what's ready, what's available to you. But, you know, from day one, if Ant hadn't been able to not only throw a punch, but sell the effort of it and sell the cost of it, which is really what's important about it.
Throw a punch and take about 11 and take at the same
Ten right for everyone. Ten you know? For everyone, that poor guy.
I mean, you talk about action movies. One of the things that really takes me out is like someone gets punched and then they're like, boom, and then they come right back with a strong right.
It didn't hurt them at all.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff that the stunt guys... we'd go over a lot of that training is about reaction. It's about how do you take the punch? What does your body do? How do you go limp? How do you like all of these things?
Yeah. I love Banshee sometimes does the POV of a guy, of someone in mid fight, and it's like blurry vision. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, that's got to be fucking so awful.
Yeah.
They're like that... barely can see like the loud ringing, you know, like that, like, what's the Spielberg Saving Private Ryan moment where it's like
tinnitus.
Well, they had that moment in 403 when they're trying to find out where Job is and they're beating that guy in the bar.
Leo.
And Carrie punches him in the face, and then you see from his POV he looks up and it's all blurry and really...
That's a great moment. That I love that scene because it's just so frank when he's like, she hits very hard. I hit harder.
It's just
that's a funny thing for like those, for a couple to be like, you know, that like because of their long relationship they know how hard each other hits.
That's such
a funny specific.
And Dennis Flanagan, who plays Leo, I mean, it's great to find people who work so well with the ensemble, you know, who come in as...
Because these guys drop... You guys are all living for 6 months in North Carolina or Pittsburgh, training together, shooting together long hours, often people don't have their families on location like that, so everyone is just hanging out with each other. And then you got to fly there, drop in and fight three of the guys guys or gals that you've never met before.
Everybody's really tight.
Yeah.
That character also is another great example of the Banshee thing where it's like he's a military contractor, but he's also a professor of internet ethics.
Yeah, that was a great reveal.
That was a great. Oh, so let's talk about 403 for a little bit because there's a lot of great moments. That chasing, that one or through the all the way up to Fat Al hitting. Fat Al is also a house favorite character on this, but of course.
Yeah.
Again, just like Banshee, just like a giant black Asian guy. He's in the head of a Chinese gang.
Yep.
That whole sequence is so exciting. And the thing we talk about the most with this episode is that it's any other show, season four would be let's rescue Job.
Right.
One whole episode would get you to Leo, who would give you a piece of information. The next whole episode would be about Job at the black site. In this show, it's like, we found Job. He's at a black site. All right, 11 minutes later, Job is rescued. Everybody's dead. Two main characters who you think might be villains. Like, the fact that the torturer is iced immediately is so fun.
Yeah, I mean, also he could easily have been the villain for the whole season.
Right, that could have been what we deal with. They're black ops, like, insane, like, torturers and stuff. And it's like, no. gone. We're done. Yeah. But Leo lives, which is a little exciting. And he's got the money. Yeah.
And Leo's, I mean, again, Eddie Cooper, who plays Fat Al and Dennis, you know, I worked with them in various capacities. Job is a very limited character in that sense. He doesn't have a lot of interaction with the primary ensemble. So even though I know them personally well and we're friends, I'm sometimes personally frustrated because I don't really get to play with them. You know?
Right, right.
But to have people that come in like Dennis and Eddie, and they are just incredible actors, but also great people. And so you feel you can trust them implicitly, you know, and you're dealing with scenes that are fairly freighted, you know, you have to lean on these people that aren't part of the core group to try to get your work done. And when they just show up and they're ready to go, that's such a great thing.
Job getting injected, that's a great moment too. Oh, I've built up an immunity to poison, that's why I doubled the dose. Like, it's like just two. That's like Vizzini and Inigo Montoya. Like, I've already developed a tolerance to poison, or it's just a great moment of like, Job is one step ahead of you, but this guy had to get two steps ahead of Job,
That Job would be one step
exactly.
ahead.
Yeah,
it's such an interesting, and you know, again, it's that sort of, like you're saying, there's a little bit extra to layer in there. The fact that he's like a fan of Job's is
right,
a little bit more than just he needs information for money. And I feel like oftentimes that's enough just to get you that small extra thing that that an actor can hook into, you know, that means something to them.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like it's his biggest rival, his idol.
Like, so what does it mean to take him down? It means something quite complex, actually. Right,
yeah, it's good. Look what I did, but also I can't believe this.
Yeah.
It's no longer infallible.
Yeah. Like,
it's also funny that there's two scenes with them walking past each other that are so significant. The first one where he captures him, and the second one where
there's
he's
a lot of
away.
Echoes of things that go on now, and we're kind of talking about it. We were like, this is the season for a lot of porch confessionals this season. It's a lot of things happening on a porch. But there's a,
excuse me,
you know, these things end up kind of showing up. There's this great scene I thought where the Lucas is returning to talk to Carrie for the first time since he's been away, and the gate to her house slides open, and it's exactly like the gates to prison opening up in the first episode. Like, this is a man that's watched barred, you know, his obstruction to his path his whole life, you know, and these bars that are constantly in front of him, and what does that mean to him? And you know, it's a
and the whole
point.
First part of the conversation is through the bars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just like, here we are again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been years, and look at how little has changed. It's a sort of thing that, again, it's a payoff for people that choose to invest, you know, beyond that point. And I'm glad that they, you know, they have that moment. They keep it on Ant's face to see those bars go by. And I'm glad they did that, you know, that sort of thing. It sort of honors the character and honors the work he put into it.
Another great Joe moment in 403 is the first time he says, let's get the fuck out. Like, when you're so worried that he's I think he is pretty broken at this point, but when you feel that flash of Job, when he's a little sassy in that moment, it was such a relief. I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Because I feel
he's not totally crushed.
Yeah, he's not totally crushed, and because the stuff you love about him will still be there, which that moment, and then when he's like, you brought me from that hellhole to this dump, just to take a shot at Sugar when he's barely back to life is such a great
moment. And that's a good example of you saying that you call Luca, he says, you heartless baby.
You know, we have a character that one thing we talked about, for example, is you know, that was I think a really great point for me that was in the script, that's in the script, you know. Again, it's a cue that's right there for you, is Job doesn't speak until he sees Lucas. You don't hear him say words, and this is a character that's hyperverbal, you know. So when does he feel safe is really the time when he can speak. So you've got to be thinking on some level, he hasn't been talking for 2 years. You know, like, there's some sense that for someone who is so verbal, who uses words as a mechanism to do so many things.
And specifically, these guys wanted you to
and
talk.
And want me to talk. Like, what does it mean to talk?
Right.
You know, especially for a character like that. You know, it would be a different thing for someone like Burton, you know, who's mostly mute.
Right.
You know? But for him to not talk. So it became this sort of thing where I think at one point there was a draft where something was said to maybe one of the captors during that sequence. And I was like, we kind of looked at that scene and I brought that potential point up. Like, do you think maybe we could not have this happen? And they were like, yeah, let's do that. And then so that became a talking point further on. It's like, okay, so maybe then it's really much more significant when he sees Lucas. Like, what does it mean for him to say something?
I love that moment when they see each other. And like, even Anthony does the, got the ice blue water eye happens at that moment when he sees Joe for the first time. I'm like, this is more exciting reunion than any other romance on the show or anything. Like, this is what I care about more than anyone getting back together with wives, girlfriends, Siobhan, sorry. Like, I'm just, this is the one, this is the reunion I've been waiting for as
you
a
know,
fan.
And I feel like one of the things that's been like kind of a watch, sort of a, and I know, like a pole star for me in this is that, you know, for a group of people that are about families torn apart, about being alone, it's like the family that matters is the family you make. It's the family you choose, right? So, and the only thing that connects those things are decisions to make the choice for that other person, right? Which is why it's such a betrayal in some people's minds that Hood gave up, right? In like in the minds of Sugar or in the minds of Carrie. But it's why Job and Hood's relationship is so important, because they don't really have anything that's actually tying them together except their history and their choice to be with one another, right? So if any person in that relationship decides they're not going to make that choice anymore, that is gone. Everything is gone, right? You don't have the tie of blood. You don't have the tie of children. You don't have the tie of legal marriage or whatever. It's only choice.
It's also an amazing moment too, because it's like Job knows that and feels that. He's also not going to let them off the hook necessarily, you know, because he says the thing about like, next time you can tell me why it took 20 months, but he's still so relieved to be back there with them, you know?
Yeah. And I think there was also a sense of, you know, one of the questions during that episode is like, what do you do in a situation like that? How do you react? Like, everybody is confronted with this reality that is just there. Everybody knows it. There's no secret. You know, they're the ones who got it. They know where he was. They know what he's been through. And there was a sense to me of like, how much is he able to put up a front? How much should he put up a front? And what does that mean for someone where the audience has maybe only seen the front? Mm. You know what I mean? And, you know, these become questions you kind of keep picking at over the course of the season and try to find some sort of resolution as quickly as possible. Yeah. You know,
shooting schedules.
But, you know.
But, like, you know, it's extra heartbreaking because of what Sugar says in, I think it's episode one, right, where he says, I hope he is dead.
Right.
So I'd feel less bad. And then when he's alive, everyone's like, fuck, we just went about our lives for about 16 months or whatever. It's hard to...
Carrie kept looking.
Carrie kept looking. Yeah, that's a great moment. That's a great... And that's just what, another thing I love about Banshee. Banshee will set you up like, we'll never find him. He's dead. Carrie's like, look, I've tried all these dead ends. And then Fat Sal's like, I got to wait. I think I got a hook. And everyone's like, yes.
Yeah.
Also, to shout Fat Sal out again, he's like, you think I'm the kind of motherfucker that doesn't know that? And points. And then, of course, his fellow Asian brethren start sniping everybody out.
Yeah. And that's, sniping is right, because there's even a shot of like a guy looking through his sniper scope shooting. Then you see the eye of the guy.
Yeah.
He shot the guy through the eye.
Yeah. Oh, you see, like, through his head. Yeah.
The classic sniper
that's
shot.
That's our two members of our stunt team. They're amazing.
They're playing those guys?
Yeah, but they're also, you know, they're tactically trained, and like, they, you know, it's a very easy thing for them to sell. It's funny because I don't know whether it's my own sort of confirmation bias or whatever, but when I look at that, it's like, oh, those guys know what they're doing. Like, sometimes I catch myself and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, my hand, like, pinky's off the gun or something. Some weird stuff is happening.
You're holding that backwards.
I know.
I just
a character choice.
Job is different. Yeah, you know, like justifying
he's got his
everything.
Own style.
We should. It's not a Job moment, but we should talk about the end of 103. Of Hood getting arrested, because we know why his blood is in the car, because she
403
Rebecca had to 403 403, sorry yeah Rebecca had to do surgery on him because he got shot with her fainting in the hospital, all that. But then we learned that, did he knock her up? The fuzzy timeline so far on season four has been so exciting, where it's like...
Something happened in those 3 months?
Yeah. Three months
when
ago.
When he was in a drunken stupor at some point.
Is it that, or are we about to find out, like, after she sews him up? Well, no, because then she wouldn't be show. Like, I wouldn't even know how to. I don't know enough about A, the female body, B, the Banshee timeline. I don't know where babies come from. we're rapidly learning, but that's a pretty crazy reveal.
The creators will be very happy that you're having this conversation. This is exactly all going to plan.
Oh yeah, it's not. Yeah, there's no way it can just be a straightforward explanation.
No, of course not.
This is Banshee.
Yeah, but it's wild. That's and so this episode also is the one that starts with the porno filming.
Yes,
and we see Carrie full vigilante.
Yeah, that's a great kind of like De Palma nod almost, where you think you're watching this fucked up.
Think we're seeing the serial killer because he's got that crazy ass mask on, and there's a blonde woman tied to the bed.
But then it's a double kind of twist, since then it's a movie, but they are also drugging and raping these people in the movie.
It's a movie, so, okay, whoo. But she's underage, it's illegal, there's drugs, she's being raped. You're like, oh, fuck, back on to being terrified of these people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that just the love of action movies, for example, the love of pulp or the love of those genres. You know, there's always these nods and winks to it throughout the show, and I felt like that was a particularly good one, because I felt it was like a nod and a wink to our own show. You know, like you could totally take this at face value in a show like ours, and then you kind of go, nah, just kidding.
We were talking about this last night watching the premiere episode of everyone in the audience laughing when the white supremacist has the fantasy about killing his boss. Where we talked about everyone laughing because you don't know on this show whether it's a fantasy or not.
Any other show you would know, like, okay, he's gonna snap to and be like, that was just me exploring a violent fantasy. But in Banshee, we're like, someone would kill their boss in front of all of their other employees with a fountain pen.
And you know what? For me, that thing, for one thing, Chris Coy's fantastic. I'm really excited for people to see what he and Tom do in this show. Again, they're
setting up some good Bunker Brothers.
Well, the theme of like family again. I mean, they're in some ways, they're one of the newest dysfunctional families to be introduced to fantasy. But
they found their other family, which was the Nazis.
Exactly. You know, and there's this sense of, what's so great about that scene, I thought, was, Chris is really does have this sort of real coiled energy in him. And so you kind of, you buy it that this character might do that. You buy it because it's the type of show as well. But I think people are, you know, in many ways, that scene ceases to be about a white supremacist killing an Asian person. It's just about killing your boss.
Right. It's more about tri-quarterlies than anything else. Right? And it didn't even occur to me that racial motivation until he says whatever, the gook or wouldn't let me leave. But it's not until that moment I was like, it just feels like a guy who's like, all right, shut up about the fucking quarterlies.
Yeah. And so that's your way into
it. It's like Office Space.
I mean, I felt like it was a real nice little sleight of hand, because now suddenly you're with this guy.
Yeah, you relate to him.
You're with this guy.
Yeah, because that boss is irritating.
That boss was played so well. Again, another Banshee, just like a one-off guy who's like, I'd really like it if you did. It's like,
weren't we late last time? Pretty sure we were.
Yeah.
And that's another one where we cut to his POV and it's like ringing anger, blurry vision anger, but not doing anything at the end. He's like, you know, like that kinetic Banshee filming is so awesome.
He's a character that it's a tough, how do you make a white supremacist sympathetic enough to get inside and go with him for the journey he has to go on, right? Because if you don't care about him in a very strong way, then you lose the ability to really invest in the problem between him and Bunker, like Tom's character, right? Calvin and Bunker. So it's like you have to kind of see from his side as well to have that.
Like that moment tension. When he says, like, I had no choice. You know that. That's like a big, where you're like, yeah, he is in a bind. And I'm like, wait a minute, why am I sympathizing with him? Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's also, we talked about this briefly with Ulrich in person. Hopefully we'll get him on the podcast. But we're like, how do you ever feel sympathy for a character who is a Amish gangster, potentially a little incestuous, kills anyone, is a criminal mastermind, and then when his niece dies, you're like, this poor guy, man. Mm-hmm. He's been through so much. You're like, wait, no, he's the bad guy.
I mean, for me, that all boils down to that scene he had with his father, like, early on, you know, and he's like, you know, like, everything you have is because of me, and it's such an elemental father-son struggle. And it's like, I think especially for if you're a man in particular, I think it resonates really strongly, you know, and you kind of, it gives you this weird free pass for so many things, not because you think they're actually right, but because you understand it. Yeah. You can understand it. And if you can understand it, then it's very hard to just flat out condemn it, because then you're condemning yourself. You're also saying, you know, well, if I have this impulse in me, if I have this thought in me, this thing that echoes with this other person, does that make me evil? Does that make me whatever?
Do you get that? Because you don't really have any dad issues at all.
No dad issues. It rarely ever comes up on this podcast or in conversation with me. An underlying theme of this, everything I do in my life is severe dad issues. It's all the same stuff. Yeah. I think pretty much this podcast is like, will you listen to me now, Pop? Look at me now. Other people pay attention to me. They don't work nights.
That's why you control the drugs on the west side of Los Angeles.
Right, so. Yes. And also, will you guys please come to my football game? So we should wrap up here soon. You're off to some sort of M country in the near future. Anything else you want to plug? Obviously, tune in. This is airing the Monday after episode 3, so we got episode 4 coming up this Friday. Don't miss it. 10 o'clock Cinemax Friday nights for the next few weeks. But do you have anything else that you want?
I just want to say, you know, especially when I started this job and I started this project, I didn't know what the reception for Joe would be like. I braced myself for every eventuality, including like utter hatred and different, you know, groups that feel socially marginalized coming at me for
how you're portraying
how this. I'm portraying it. And I was like, this is probably part of the job, you know, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. And the fact that people embrace the character as they did and have continued to do has meant everything to me. And I think I can speak for the rest of the team as well, that the support, you know, we always felt like the underdog and sort of this show that was just had to prove itself all the time. And it's very difficult to put our show together without, you know, throughout these long days and all of this pressure and fatigue and explosions and all these things. And just knowing that people were waiting for it and waiting to love it, not just waiting to see what we did and then judge it, but waiting to love it. It meant everything. It gave us every ounce of fuel that we needed and more than we had. And so I just want to say personally, like, it's the best job I've ever had. And it's given me incredible amount personally. So, and that's really all from the people that have supported it, yourselves and other people all around the world, actually.
You're welcome. I would say, just to, again, continue the smoke up ass process, sure. But I think part of the reason why that people appreciate the Job character so much, because it is you're walking a crazy line there. There's an ability to, you know, just a character that is potentially offensive to certain groups or whatever. I think it's a lot because of the writing too, but your portrayal of the character and the way you play it is, it's amazing. It's a great character.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fear with something like that is like, is it a stereotype? Is it a whatever? And it's so clearly a real person in the world of Banshee, but, you know,
real Banshee person. Quotes. Yeah,
but people don't recognize, or they don't have visibility to the, like, you could have a lot of ideas as an actor, you could have a lot of specificity in mind. If you don't have an environment that allows that, that's all for naught. And so, you know, the things that people don't see about conversations where someone says, instead of saying, let's just do this, they say, try it, you know, and to be working in that environment with a character that you know, made me nervous, you know, to approach at various times for various reasons. You know, that made all the difference. But everybody, I think, was kind of had it in their minds that if we are able to put forth our best effort, then we can at least stand behind that, whether people like it or not. We can at least say we did what we thought was the right thing. And I think that when people tune into this season, I hope that what they understand is every season we have tried to avoid as much as possible resting on the successes we've had in the past and trying to
apparent so far. Yeah. Like if you open up your fourth and final season with a main character's naked body cut open and it's like 18 months earlier, that is you're taking swings and that's all that you can ask. I think that's what everyone that's what draws us to Banshee, is that they're going to take swings. You connect almost every time. Yeah. I mean, I'm saying almost as if I have one moment in mind, but I don't.
No.
But it's like one of those things where it's like taking those wild swings is what I think the Banshee fans like.
I hope so. I mean, and it's really that's what we're trying to do. It's not. It's motivated expressly by that. Like, we know we have to take risks. Like, we have to, because this is exactly the type of show that if we don't, it's all done. It's all over. You know, like the moment that happens. So.
Since we're wrapping up here, can we just make one corny request? Can you call us motherfuckers, please? Can Job call us a motherfucker?
Bitch, I ain't a dog and I don't do motherfucking tricks.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'm sorry to have asked that corny question, but I needed to hear that. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening,
my
guys.
Pleasure.
Banshee,
thanks,
Friday nights at 10. Ben Rogers, Sean Conroy, you know their Twitter handles by now, ideally. Or
so.
No one's listening to this at all. Right. And this has all been a fun exercise in discussing Banshee. Later, shitheads.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.